During this challenging cold and flu season, supporting your immune health is top priority. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with an effective 1-2 punch from our friends at Protocol for Life Balance. Protocol's abiotic soft gels and Sambucus Black Elderberry Liquid both have vital natural compounds that help your immune system fight what the season throws at you. Go to drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance for more information and to order these great products. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And once again, it's time to answer questions for our listeners. Questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer listener questions. We appreciate all the questions we've been getting. We encourage you to send more because we just keep plowing through your questions and we want to tackle more.
Yes.
So, radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. And we got a bunch of questions in the mailbag this week, don't we, Layla?
We do. Actually, we have one from Bonnie. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I'm accustomed to seeing negative articles in the press about integrative medicine, but since this article was published in BMC Complementary and Alternative Medicine, I would appreciate it if you'd evaluate and report on it. My daughter, who gives her 5-year-old son probiotics every day, read it and is now concerned. Here's the title of the article. Are infectious complications following probiotics an underestimated problem? And basically, it refers to high-risk patients. It's a small patient population, but she'd like us to weigh in on this. It's a synthesis and critical evaluation of the reports and series of causes on the infectious complications related to the ingestion of probiotics, which can raise awareness for prescribing and use of probiotics for certain groups of patients. This is not meant to discourage use of probiotics, but to better understand that...
By the way, you're quoting from BMJ.
I am.
Correct.
But okay. It's better to understand that certain high-risk patients may not benefit from the introduction of probiotics in a clinical setting.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
It is true. And you know, there's much that we have to understand about probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
That it's different strokes for different folks.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, probiotics are extremely beneficial. For others, the results are equivocal. And for others, the results can be negative.
Yeah.
For example, there was a study that suggests that patients who have SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, may be counterproductive to introduce more bacteria.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes, yes.
Especially lactobacillus, which can cause lactic acidosis, which then they, in one study, and I criticized the study because I thought it was a setup for failure, that it caused brain fog in some patients.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So brain fog, I mean, you know, it's not a serious life-threatening complication, but let's say you have a patient in the intensive care unit and they're getting multiple antibiotics, as is often the case in the intensive care unit in patients who are suffering from overwhelming infections, pneumonia, elderly patients. You know, that's one of the reasons why I left conventional medicine. ICU medicine is heroic in many cases, but in many cases just prolongs the agony of patients who are simply dying. They used to call pneumonia the old man's friend, you know, dispatch you at some advanced age. And now they, through the miracle of antibiotics, they can keep you alive so that you can languish a few weeks or months longer. Coming back to the theme of the probiotics, in a setting of a really severely compromised immune system, it's possible that these bacteria may overgrow.
Yes.
And they may, I mean, worst case scenario, they may cause a systemic infection, but most of these probiotics are benign. But there's so many that we don't know that some people who are very immunosuppressed, they might one or another strain of a multi- part probiotic may infect that person.
Right.
You know.
Right. You want to get the right battalion in there to fight the contagion or to fight the bad bacteria. In the case of SIBO, I've heard it said that, you know, when you take a probiotic at the wrong time, without killing out the bad bacteria first, it's as if that beneficial bacteria in the probiotic mm-hmm. introduces joining the SIBO
right.
party.
So that we might say that, in, coming back to the example of SIBO, we might want to put patients on a FODMAP diet, low FODMAP
yes.
diet, reduce the proliferation of bacteria, or put them on an SCD, a specific
yes.
carbohydrate diet.
Which is very effective.
Then maybe use some botanicals to suppress the growth of harmful mm-hmm. bacteria, even use an antibiotic like rifaximin.
Yeah.
And then repopulate the gut, because we know that the gut,
yeah.
you know, ultimately you don't want to so severely curtail the beneficial bacteria. You want to reintroduce them at some point.
Yes.
But when it comes to children, children have incomplete immune systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may be that with children, we may want to exercise caution using more gentle strains like
sure.
bifidobacteria, which seems to be more well accepted by the infant GI tract.
Mm-hmm. This is a 5-year-old.
Oh, it's
yeah.
a 5-year-old. You know, so generally, 5-year-olds have a more developed gastrointestinal immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think there's a particular concern in a healthy 5-year-old. You
yeah.
know, maybe a 5-year-old who, God forbid, is undergoing treatment for leukemia or something.
Yeah.
You know, with powerful chemotherapy, or somebody who's just had a bone marrow transplant or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, we might be careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the theory, again, was that, and they've done studies, patients in the ICU who are so depleted of beneficial bacteria that they might get a benefit from the probiotics. And the studies were equivocal. They
yes.
were not showing, you know, mm-hmm. they were showing a few cases of harm, some cases of benefit, net, that sort of netted out to zero.
Yeah.
In terms of net benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think it is an appropriate concern, but it's not a concern that should be translated to the general population
yeah.
that BMJ has raised.
Yeah. And again, it's not meant to discourage the use of probiotics. So the
as they say, as they say themselves
yeah.
In BMJ, and
mm-hmm.
BMJ is a pretty, you know, it's conservative, but it's sort of... shall we say, a progressive conservative medical journal in terms of its flavor? Yeah, I mean, all these medical journals tend to be a little going negative on supplements,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
BMJ has a little bit the flavor of openness and acceptance to supplements.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, I just want to throw in, you know, an article that I wrote last week. Talk a little bit about it. It's about the theory that statins mm-hmm. May make you fat.
Oh, yeah.
And
does the statin make me fat? I love the title and I love the picture.
Does this statin make me look fat? And then yeah. there's this woman standing there, you know, trying on jeans, and she just looks like she just squeezed into them, and she's kind of,
uh-huh.
you know, it's a really good picture that our graphics department came up with for that.
Uh-huh.
And so the idea being that... some people gain weight on statins.
Mm.
And it appears that there's maybe a couple of reasons for that. One is that statins may cause you to abandon restraint when it comes to diet, because it's like, it's handled. You know, I'm like, my cholesterol's great.
Yes.
You know, so I can eat what I want. You know, it's the same psychology as using, a Nexium or something
mm-hmm.
like that. Just like, taking Nexium, I can eat those, you know, chili dogs with impunity,
yeah.
you know, or the, you know, bacon cheeseburgers, and I'm not, you know, I'm fine. I don't have any problem.
I heard somebody, an elderly person in my family, say recently, I think it was over Christmas, well, I had a little more cake, so I took a little more Lipitor.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
That perfect example. Mm-hmm. Perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually, some studies have shown that there is a weight gain associated
yeah.
with that. So part of it is what's called a removal of moral hazard. You know, because you take away, I mean, it's like...
the Lipitor takes care of it. I'll do whatever I want.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, I guess some people have said that in relationship to, you know, welfare. You know, it's like disincentive to work, you know.
Yes.
And when you have a disincentive to... regulate your cholesterol through natural means, through exercise and diet,
mm-hmm.
maybe you gain weight. Because number one. Okay, so number two, there is a metabolic slowdown that occurs in many people who take statins. And this has been demonstrated, and I talk about it in the article, is that it's very subtle, and it can be easily confused with, hey, you know, I don't feel like I did a couple of years ago, but, you know, hey, Then I was 62. Now I'm 64. I guess this is the aging process, and you don't know because you're taking that statin and you believe it's helping you and you're a couple of years older. So which is it? Which is slowing you down? Why can't you perform that well on the treadmill? Why do you feel less initiative to exercise?
Let's remind the listeners that muscle fatigue is a very big side effect.
Thank you.
Of statins. It literally destroys CoQ10.
Yeah. And so the why that's controversial is that it's a subtle thing. So if you have crashing muscle fatigue, devastating muscle fatigue,
rhabdomyolysis,
right, it might show up in a blood test. You'll have a test called a CPK, which is elevated. Mm-hmm. And the doctor will say, you're one of that very, we know that there's like 1% of people, 2% of people take statins have this, I don't know, it's a genetic thing. They don't tolerate them well. Mm-hmm. So you've got that. I'm sorry. You know, we'll give you a much lower dose. So we'll do something else. We'll give you a different medication. That's recognized. But what about the people who are a little subtle stuff? And they go to the doctor, and they complain to the doctor, and the doctors often poo-poo that. They say, look, you can't have muscle fatigue because I tested you and your CPK is normal. You can't have muscle fatigue. Mm-hmm. But actually, I cite studies there which show that a fairly high percentage, especially of elderly patients, 70-75 is the cutoff, have some degree, maybe as high as 20%, that's acknowledged muscle fatigue. And what about just a little subtle muscle fatigue? So you feel less like exercising. So you gain weight. So that's number. So the other thing that just came out, it's very interesting, is that there's this thing called brown fat.
Yeah.
Brown fat is what it's the good fat. It's mm-hmm. called bat fat, mm-hmm. or brown adipose tissue, which interestingly enough is very prevalent in bats and other rodents. And it's designed as a thermogenic fat. It's a fat burning tissue. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it burns fat as a fuel.
Yeah.
And it's a very active, it's not a storage depot for fat,
like the white adipose tissue.
Right. Which is the jelly roll that you have. That's just like the camel's hump, that's sort of like, your reserve. Mm-hmm. And the brown adipose tissue was thought to be, non-existent in adults. It was found in children. This was actually related to the fact that children can't shiver. Adults can shiver, children can't shiver for some reason, but they burn brown fat to adapt to the cold, okay?
That's interesting.
So anyway, once they thought children, whatever, they're neurologically capable of, their autonomic nervous system allows them to shiver, they can use the shivering to warm themselves somehow. I don't know the exact circuitry by which that happens. They don't need the brown fat. So humans don't have brown fat past the age of, puberty. I don't know what the cutoff was. But then they discovered that humans do have very small amounts of brown adipose tissue. And it is associated with metabolic wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reduced in metabolic syndrome and in overweight and obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And also it can be induced by being exposed to the cold.
Yeah, cold.
Yeah, which is why I went swimming yesterday in the pool. I said, boy, the pool's really, for some reason, it was a very cold day. And the pool wasn't that heated, but the idea is that this is a lap pool. This isn't just a splash pool like a kiddie play pool. This is like you're supposed to do your business in that pool. You're not supposed to,
do your laps.
Just hang out. Mm-hmm. So the pool was, I don't know, whatever, cold. It's like 72 degrees maybe. That feels cold.
Yeah.
I figured, hey, I'm going to, that's a good thing because I'm going to, as I walk outside and as I swim in cold water, mm-hmm. I'm going to reinvigorate my brown fat.
Uh-huh.
Well, statins block the formation of brown fat.
Oh.
So that's a plausible mechanism by which statins can make you look fat. And that just came out, a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new.
So there's been also the introduction. I think I'm not sure if it's still in vogue, Dr. Hoffman. Remember, the cold rooms to help kickstart fat burning?
Yeah.
You walk into this freezing temperature room with very little on for I don't know how long.
Yeah.
Before you're frostbitten, I hope.
Right, right.
And to help
that's
stir.
That's my bedroom.
That's my bedroom.
Once there was there was a construction worker, somebody doing some remodeling in my, mm-hmm. when I had my kitchen done, And he left one of these things that's actually, it's a temperature control thing. You have, your husband's a contractor. You know,
yes.
You can point like a laser-like device at things,
yeah.
And it checks the temperature.
He goes out the door every morning to check the temperature that day,
right.
So he knows what kind of temperature
so anyway,
he's working
this
in.
This guy left this expensive tool, so we called up and we said, come back and pick it up. In the meantime, I played
it's
around
like
with it.
$150,
yeah,
at least.
Right. I went to the bedroom. I checked the temperature, yeah. You know, before I got under the covers. It was like 58 degrees in the bedroom. And I thought,
that's a good temperature for sleeping.
Oh, yeah.
For sleeping.
And for brown fat formation.
Yeah. For those of you who want to try this at home, set your thermostat to 60 degrees and then be in your house with little more than a t-shirt. I'm talking wife beater t-shirt.
Sit in your skivvies.
Sit in your skivvies. Just hang out.
Right.
You know, don't be in your sweatshirt and a cardigan and your cuddle duds and the other thing for 60 degrees. Be in practically nothing.
Well, the other thing you can do is you can go, you know, we used to have, older buildings have this. We used to have what's called tar beach on our roofs.
I used to live
in a fifth floor walk-up, and then you'd go up one more floor, and it was tar beach.
Yeah.
And it was like, because they used tar on the rooftops of brownstones, yeah. And I used to sit up there and sun myself in the summer. Mm-hmm. But in the winter, you could sit there, and you could induce brown fat formation.
Brown fat, yeah. Wow.
So,
all the way from probiotics to brown fat. Okay.
Well, we're nothing if not ADD here.
Exactly.
On the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
But these are important topics.
Yeah.
These are things people need to know. Oh, wow. Bonnie, thank you for your very thoughtful question. All right. Oh, we've got a nice note here from Aaron.
A-A-R-O-N or E-R-I-N?
No, E-E-R-I-N, Aaron.
Aaron, as in she. Like Irish female name.
Yeah. She writes, please thank Dr. Hoffman for the article on Candida. I'm a 46-year-old female who, as a child, was a patient of Dr. Crook.
Wow, that's quite a distinction because Dr. Crook,
yeah.
Unfortunate name.
Yeah.
But Dr. Crook was a pioneer in the understanding of and popularization of the notion of Candida,
yeah.
or the yeast connection. And he wrote the book, The Yeast Connection. And he was quite a Southern gentleman. He was from Tennessee,
uh-huh.
And I had the opportunity to meet him on a few occasions, and he is deceased.
Hmm.
But he really created practically single-handedly this paradigm. He
yes.
wasn't the originator of it, but he was the popularizer of it.
Yes. Aaron says, let me just skip down to the bottom of
sure.
this email. I will also never forget my mom saying to Dr. Crook, I don't like your name. Are you really a thief? And he said, I'm not a thief. My name is like the crook in the shepherd's staff.
Like it. Like it. Yeah, no, that's the way he would talk.
Yeah. So Erin says, she felt like she nearly died of Candida, living in Virginia in the coal mine area. Constant vague symptoms plagued my body, which made mainstream doctors question the legitimacy
yes, sure. mm-hmm.
of the symptoms.
Yeah.
Dr. Hoffman's article was so on the button of how we lived in the 80s trying to figure out vague symptoms and navigate the troubled waters of doctors who believed us, our symptoms, and doctors who didn't. Anyway, I'm happily married, a healthy mother of two. I often have people talk to me about my experiences. They have vague symptoms as well, and I always point them to the yeast connection.
Mm-hmm. Now, so what yeah. I think she's referring to is an article that I wrote about a year ago or so, which is how the yeast connection over time has become vindicated
yeah.
and made more sophisticated and expanded upon, because in the old days, it was like either you were fine or you were dying of disseminated fungal infection.
Mm.
And we actually, especially in the AIDS yeah. days, we had patients who were so immunocompromised that they had literally, you draw blood and you could look under the microscope, you see budding yeast in their blood or other fungal species like, you know, cryptoformans, cryptococcal things.
Yeah, yeah.
These are fungal species that...
Mycoplasma.
Yeah, that inhabit people who have no immune system whatsoever. So they would say, look, if you don't have AIDS, you don't have Candida.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
might have a skin infection. Okay, put some monostat on that, mm-hmm. you know, vaginal infection, you know, or you put some mm-hmm. topical, you know, Lotrizone or something on that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that'll take care of it because there's no such thing as a systemic yeast infection. Well, now we know
that there is.
Candida is highly immuno reactive. It may not necessarily have to swim in the bloodstream to create problems in the body.
And we're talking about Candida albicans.
Right. We've also expanded this to the notion of bacterial dysbiosis.
Yes.
So that you don't just have yeast in your intestine, you also have bacterial imbalance that affects you through leaky gut syndrome. It could create autoimmune disease. And lately, the new finding, very exciting, is that fungal infections can affect the brain and cause Alzheimer's disease. But you don't have to be, you don't have to have a temperature of 104 to have this kind of fungal infection.
Wow.
So, you know, people used to say, well,
it would not even induce a fever. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. With just a very slow, low-grade chronic infection, they actually find traces of fungal residue in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's. So I'm not saying that, you know, uniformly Alzheimer's is caused by yeast, but it's a new perspective on this. And the other way, of course, that yeast can create problems is that we call this autobrewery syndrome, and I talk about that in the article, is that you have a distillery in your gut, and this there are cases in the medical literature of patients who, without drinking, have had positive breathalyzer tests, and they're accused of being stealth drinkers. They're put on metabolic wards where they're locked in and they have no access to alcohol, and then they use the breathalyzer and say, "Oh my God, you're breathing ethanol is coming off your breath." And then when they're given antifungal medication, that autobrewery syndrome dissipates because they kill off this yeast.
Right.
And after all, you know, I just was in Belgium and I saw all the breweries there, and they use yeast to make beer.
Yeah. So that autobrewery, that distillery in the gut, is responsible for so much brain fog. Yeasty people are a little bit, quote, drunk or tipsy.
Yeah.
And that's the reason for that particular symptom. So anyway, Erin tells this wonderful story about how she got better being Dr. Crook's patient. Mm-hmm. She was also a patient in Chicago for a month under the care of Dr. Theron Randolph. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think he was.
And you know, this recalls the patient who we saw last week together. This is the woman, she's 50-ish. And she came for something else, but she described, she was referred by her physician, who's no longer in the New York area. And she initially went to that physician for treatment of anxiety and depression.
Yes.
And through diet change and supplements, that was completely alleviated.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just...
It's not a miracle, folks. It works.
She went on a paleo diet,
yeah.
You know, no sugar, and, you know, avoided common allergens. And her, you know, her mood completely was transformed. And she had tried antidepressant medication. She had horrible side effects on antidepressant medication. She didn't tolerate them. Perhaps fortunately, because there was a better way.
Yes. Yes. And her physician found it. All right. Erin, we wish you continued good health. That's absolutely wonderful news. We have a question from Barbara. And we'd had a similar question before, Dr. Hoffman. Can you please tell me the difference between phosphatidylserine and phosphatidylcholine? I have the latter. Is it as good? Well, they're both important.
Mm-hmm.
Phosphatidylserine generally helps with memory.
Right.
The
way to remember
that
is PS, I forgot.
Yes, I
forgot. Right. So it's sometimes abbreviated PS.
PS.
And how does it work? Is it work as a membrane constituent in the neurons? Is that how it works?
I think that's more phosphatidylcholine.
Phosphatidylcholine certainly works that way.
But
phosphatidylcholine also has the property of being a precursor to acetylcholine. Which is a neurotransmitter that actually is a target in some of the Alzheimer's medications.
Yes.
You know, like
Aricept.
Aricept will boost acetylcholine. So. Mm-hmm. PC is a building block. PC also has benefits for the liver. We use it in patients who have fatty liver.
That's phosphatidylcholine, yes.
PC.
Yes, yes. Helps with the firing of neurons, all of that. We need choline. I know there have recently been articles about, oh no, choline is a bad.
Choline, you know, with a TMAO connection, which is something I want to write about in a subsequent newsletter. You know, the concern that that's not good, but, you know, it depends.
It ultimately has to do with our gut microbes.
Yep.
What happens with that TMAO?
Right. That's a whole other topic. We can tackle that in a future date. But anyway, so phosphatidylserine, I have to say that I'm looking for more recent validation of phosphatidylserine in the literature, and I think the research interest is calming down a little bit on that, which suggests that maybe it's becoming less of a primary player in brain support. Maybe but it's in most of the formulas for brain support.
Right. Maybe it's not as great as, say, huperzine or Bacopa or acetyl L-carnitine.
True Niagen. Nicotinamide riboside.
Which is amazing for so many things, as it turns out. So, Barbara, you have phosphatidylcholine. Absolutely take it. If you find that you have any type of memory issue, phosphatidylserine wouldn't hurt.
Yeah. And it's in many of the formulas that we... there's a formula by Claire, which is Neurothera, and Neurothera has the phosphatidylserine, and I think PC. They sort of hedge their bets by putting both in many formulas.
Yeah, so you can get both that way.
Yeah,
you can get that at drhoffman.com. Click on the store.
drhoffmanstore.com, and go to FullScript, and they'll ask you to register. You don't have to buy anything if you register. You can just browse the store, and if it seems reasonable and you want to access products, you can do so there. That's the story.
Thank you, Barbara, for your question.
All right. Let us pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts. And so, looking forward to part two, what's our next question?
Oh, I've read reports about strontium side effects. Do you still recommend it? Are you concerned about its risks?
Well, short answer, spoiler alert, I sure do, and I'll tell you why in part two.
Yes.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin, and it's our weekly Q&A with Layla, answering your questions about nutrition and medicine. Radio program at AOL.com, the destination for questions. We'll be right back with part two.